content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week we're reading from the edition dated August 5th, 2011. And our first item from the Week magazine this week, of course, the most timely item of all these days relating to the debt ceiling. The article is entitled "The End Game on the Debt Ceiling." What happened? Fierce negotiations on how to hike the $14.3 trillion debt ceiling were set to go down to the wire as the week went to press this past week, with just days remaining before the government runs out of cash to pay its bills. And as you probably know by now, the debt ceiling issue was agreed upon by both the House and the Senate, the Senate approving it on Tuesday around midday, and it was scheduled to go to the president for signature before midnight in time to beat that ominous deadline. The talks between President Obama and House Speaker John Boehner had broken down last weekend, leaving two proposals from Capitol Hill as the only options to avoid default under discussion. One plan, proposed by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, the Democrat from Nevada, set out to reduce the deficit by $2.7 trillion over 10 years and raise the debt ceiling to last through the 2012 elections. The other, drawn up by Boehner, aimed to cut spending immediately by $1.2 trillion and raise the debt ceiling only until February. Neither one calls for tax increases, and both would create a bipartisan committee to identify further spending cuts. Some House Republicans said Boehner's proposal doesn't cut deeply enough, and Reid said it would be dead on arrival in the Senate. But Reid's approach faced stiff resistance, too, leading some to suggest that the best hope lay in melding the two plans together. "The commonality is pretty apparent between the two different proposals," said Senator John Kyle, a Republican from Arizona. President Obama, who could not convince Republicans to back a $4 trillion grand bargain of tax cuts and revenue increases, used a national TV address to plead with the GOP to put aside pride and party and compromise with Democrats before the August 2nd deadline. "The entire world is watching," he said. In a televised response, Boehner accused the president of demanding a blank check to carry on irresponsible spending. "That is just not going to happen," he said. "The prospect of imminent default caused an anxious stock market to fall throughout the week." Now, here's what the editorial said. "The country deserves more from its president than political theater," said the Wall Street Journal. "That's all voters are getting from a leader more concerned about the 2012 elections than the country's fiscal health. Obama used his speech to shift the blame to the GOP if the country slides into default, even though it was his spending blowout that got us into this mess. Only the Republicans are serious about getting us out of it." "It was actually the GOP that ignited this artificial crisis," said the New York Times, "by holding the U.S. economy to ransom. The Democrats have bowed to the Republicans' every demand, but not even Harry Reid's last-ditch surrender will satisfy them. The contents of the deal have nothing to do with it. It's the very idea of compromise that they can't stand. Now we're exactly where the GOP wants us, on the brink of ruinous default." And here's what the columnist said. "It's worth looking at how this began," said Felix Salmon in Reuters.com. "It dates back to 2001 when George W. Bush squandered Bill Clinton's hard-earned fiscal rectitude on tax cuts. Since then, no Republican or Democrat has worked to shrink the deficit, creating a vicious dynamic in which both parties are happy to spend but reluctant to tax. That was bound to end in tears sooner or later." Prepare to shed them now, said Simon Johnson in Slate.com. A government default next week would destroy the credit system as we know it, crippling the private sector and causing a run on banks as people desperately withdraw their savings. But we don't need to default, said Charles Gasparino in the New York Post. Even if the debt ceiling isn't raised, investors know the Treasury will make essential bond payments and hold off sending other checks until Congress reaches a deal. Whatever happens next week, says James Sirowiecki in The New Yorker, we should abolish the debt ceiling. It's an anachronism that rewards fanaticism over responsible budgeting. Our economy has done enough problems, or has had enough problems, without ones we've created for ourselves. The damage has already been done, said Jonathan Chait in The New Republic. The GOP has exposed a glaring fault at the center of our political system by demonstrating the vast power available to an opposition party willing to deploy it. What's frightening is that such indiscriminate blocking actions will become a regular feature of American politics for many years to come. And now that the debt ceiling has been raised officially, there's an updated article on this week's edition of The Week online, and I thought I would share that with you because it gives some opinions about how the whole deal affected the president. The title of this online article is, Is the Debt Deal a Disaster for President Obama? Republicans got just about everything they wanted in the debt deal, while President Obama got very little, at least for now. Here are some of the opinions from the editorial writers that occurred just earlier this week. The debt ceiling deal hammered out over the weekend is the lowest moment of Obama's presidency, says Michael Tomosky at the Daily Beast. Echoing many liberals and even some conservatives, Tomosky argues that by letting Republicans and Tea Partiers have just about everything they want while giving up many of his own key demands, like increased revenue to lower the deficit, Obama has done terrible, lasting damage to his political fortunes, his party, and the economy. Is the debt deal really so bad for Obama? Yes, this is a disaster. Obama didn't just lose his standoff with Tea Partiers. He surrendered on a grand scale to raw extortion, says Paul Krugman in the New York Times. That makes him look weak and emboldens further blackmail on the part of right-wing extremists. Worse, the terrible policy demands the GOP extracted will sink the already depressed economy, and with it, Obama's re-election hopes. It's hard to see this as anything but a political catastrophe. The deal isn't so bad for Obama. If he raised a white flag, at least, the terms of surrender are to Obama's advantage, says Andrew Sullivan at the Daily Beast. He defused the debt ceiling bomb until after the 2012 election and helped open a chasm in the GOP between Tea Partiers and other GOP factions. And on top of that, Obama won his own battle. He is perceived as more likely to compromise than the GOP in a country whose independent middle wants compromise. Obama lost, but he set himself up for victory later. The horrible deal is probably about as non-bad as it could have gotten for Obama once he agreed to negotiate a ransom payment, says Jonathan Chait at the New Republic. Luckily, it leaves him one golden ticket. He still controls the fate of the Bush tax cuts, which are set to expire in December 2012. If Obama uses that leverage to turn the tables on the GOP, this debt deal is just a shrewd strategic defeat. If he won't, it's the largest in a series of historic capitulations. Our next item on the world stage here, Norway reels after the terrorist attack. What happened? Well, more than 150,000 Norwegians rallied in Oslo this week to mourn the 76 people killed in back-to-back attacks by a far-right extremist. Anders Behring Breivik, 32 years old, began his rampage last Friday afternoon, setting off a car bomb outside government buildings in downtown Oslo, killing eight. As emergency personnel rushed to the scene, the blonde-haired, blue-eyed bomber made his way north to the island of Utøya, where hundreds of youths were attending a summer camp organized by the ruling Labour Party. Dressed as a policeman, Breivik asked children and adults to gather round him. He opened fire on the crowd with an automatic machine gun, and for the next hour methodically hunted his victims down, killing some as they tried to swim away from the island. He was so cold and concentrated, said survivor Adrian Prakken, 21. By the time police arrived on Utøya, 68 people, including many teens, were dead. Breivik surrendered without resistance. Later, the killer told police that attacks were atrocious but necessary to save Norway and Western Europe from cultural Marxism and Muslim domination. His motivations were expanded upon in a 1,516-page online manifesto packed with quotes from U.S.-based anti-Muslim blogs. In the document, the feminist-hating Breivik claimed to be a member of a new Knights Templars dedicated to restoring Europe's Christian and patriarchal roots. At the Oslo Memorial Service, Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg said he would deny Breivik any victory by making Norway even more open and tolerant. We shall not seek revenge, he said. We shall stand together in our sorrow. Now here's what the editorial said. Right-wing American bloggers aren't to blame for this outrage, said the Los Angeles Times, but the Norway attacks should cause some introspection among Muslim bashers. For years, the bigots behind sites like Jihad Watch have blamed all Muslims for the actions of a minority of violent jihadists. Now that some commentators are accusing these hate mongers of aiding and abetting Breivik, they're finally getting a taste of what they've been dishing out for years. The left-wing punditocracy should be ashamed, said the Boston Herald. They've rejoiced in the fact that some conservative bloggers were mentioned in Breivik's writings, as if that puts those writings on a par with a mass murderer. We need to examine the dangers posed by extreme Islamophobes. But right now, we should focus on joining Norway in mourning, not using their dead as fodder for the latest blame game. Now here's what the columnist said. Could an anti-Muslim bigot commit a large-scale terrorist attack in the U.S., asked Peter Beinart in the DailyBeast.com. Absolutely. What makes a Breivik-style attack possible is that terrorism usually results from the intersection between militant ideology and mentally vulnerable people. And Islamophobia is now as common on the political right as the militia-style anti-government rhetoric of the 1990s that inspired the Oklahoma City bombing. So when Newt Gingrich makes doomsday predictions about his grandchildren growing up in an America dominated by radical Islamists, we should be aware that somewhere out there, someone like Breivik is listening. Don't blow this neo-Nazi threat out of proportion, said Benny Avni in the New York Post. For starters, right-wing extremists generally operate in isolation, while Islamic terrorists have a network of combat-ready cells everywhere from Afghanistan to America. And let's be clear that this was the work of a solitary madman, said Mark Stein in National Review. I've been fitted out for a supporting role in Breivik's slaughter because he quoted my work on the threat of Islamism. But he also cited Mark Twain, Gandhi, and philosophers John Locke and Edmund Burke. And when a fanatic uses Locke and Burke as justification for slaying teenagers, he is lost in his own psychoses. Breivik isn't mad, said Andrew Sullivan in the DailyBeast.com. He's extremely sane. Read his manifesto and you'll realize that his murderous rampage was just an extreme and violent extension of the far right's revulsion at Muslims, feminism, and multiculturalism. He did what he did, knowing it was evil, because of a passionate commitment to a political cause which he'd fused with a parody of Christianity and a paranoid hatred of Islam. If you think that contains no lessons for the United States, you might want to open your eyes a little more widely. And now let's look at the controversy of the week from the Week magazine, birth control. Should it be free? Free universal health care may still be a long way off, said the New York Times in an editorial, but free universal birth control is about to become a reality. During last year's heated wrangling over the health care bill, President Obama sidestepped one bitter fight by having the nonpartisan Institute of Medicine decide the thorny question of whether birth control and family planning counseling count as preventive medicine. The IOM last week issued the sound medical advice that they do, meaning that as of 2013, all U.S. insurance carriers will likely have to cover the entire cost of contraception for women without even charging a copay. This is a huge win for women, said Sharon Lerner in The Nation, and for all Americans, whatever their politics. A shocking 49% of U.S. pregnancies are unplanned, partly because poor women often lack effective birth control. About half of those pregnancies currently end in abortion. So anti-abortion conservatives should be cheering the advent of free contraception as loudly as anyone. Free birth control has nothing to do with protecting women's health, said Jeffrey Kuhner in the Washington Times. Rather, it is about consolidating the sexual revolution. The cultural left has been on a mission since the 1960s to install the hippie notions of free love and sexual promiscuity at the heart of mainstream American culture. And the coming age of free contraception will represent the final triumph of those efforts. Many religious people consider contraception a sin, said Sister Mary Ann Walsh in WashingtonPost.com. Not only do some so-called morning-after pills cause the death of a fertilized embryo, an abortion, in other words, but all contraception, by its very nature, deprives human sexual intimacy of an essential part of its depth and meaning, the possibility of creating new life. At the very least, therefore, any new laws must come with religious exemptions to ensure that those who are morally opposed to contraception don't have their insurance premiums used to pay for it. You don't have to be religious to have concerns about free contraception, said the Wilmington, Delaware News Journal. Men and women should share a mutual responsibility for the consequences of sexual activity. But the new ruling treats birth control exclusively as an aspect of women's health, which could send young, irresponsible men the message that it isn't their problem. Besides, said Michael New in NationalReview.com, what is free contraception actually going to achieve? Only 12% of women who don't use birth control cite cost as a factor, and government efforts to promote or subsidize contraception have, historically, done nothing to lower the number of unplanned pregnancies. This is really just another step down the road to politicized medicine, where decisions about what's best for patients are made by ideologues in Washington. The truth, said Tracy Clark Flory in Salon.com, is that most private insurers already cover the whole cost of birth control for their female clients. Why? Because unplanned pregnancies are demonstrably bad for women's health and create large medical costs. Improving access to birth control makes such costly pregnancies less likely. As for the moral and ethical questions, letting pro-lifers opt out of their insurance premiums would be like letting pacifists pay less in federal tax because they're morally opposed to the military. Free contraception, like national defense, is a common-sense measure that benefits all of us, which is why 77% of Americans of all political persuasions say they welcome its arrival. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for this week. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we're going to turn to the very popular article entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for remembering your kid's birthday after Jackie Parker of New York gave birth to a son on July 19th. Jackie and her husband Paul were also born on July 19th. I never thought it would actually happen, Jackie said. It was a good week for sleeping through the night after the Crowne Plaza hotel chain started testing its first snore absorption rooms with soundproof walls and snore patrols to knock on the doors of those who are snoring thunderously. And it was a good week for decadence after a Malaysian businessman bought the world's most expensive yacht for $5 billion. The 100-foot boat is plated in gold and has bedrooms covered in platinum and a statue made from a T-Rex bone. This will never be topped, said designer Stuart Hughes. And it was a bad week for Jared Medeiros of California after the 21-year-old tried to retrieve his wallet from a manhole. Rescue workers found Medeiros waist-deep in the manhole, his legs flailing in the air. It was a bad week for onophiles after a faulty forklift dropped 462 cases of Australian Shiraz, leaving a spreading red puddle worth $1 million. This wine is our pride and joy, said winemaker Sparky Marquis. We just couldn't believe it. And it was a bad week for relaxing vacations after 170 people voluntarily checked into the new jail in Cole County, Missouri. The guests were booked and photographed, ate in the prison dining hall, and slept in cells in steel bunks. It was something they could experience without having to get a criminal record, Sheriff Greg White explained. And now from the Week magazine, let's turn to the People section and see what's happening this week. Our first item, the rise of Rory. Rory McIlroy is feeling the pressure, said Cole Morton in the London Daily Mail. In June, McIlroy won golf's U.S. Open in convincing fashion, posting the lowest score in the tournament's 111-year history. Suddenly, the shaggy-haired boyish Irishman is being hailed as the heir apparent to the fallen Tiger Woods. The way my life is changing does worry me a bit, to be honest, but I just try to concentrate on the game, says McIlroy, who just turned 22 years old. It's been a strange year, the way things have panned out. I knew I had to up the intensity at the start of the year, but I never thought it would go like this. Like Woods, McIlroy was tutored early on by his father, who eventually took three jobs to pay for his son's professional coaching. This is not about pushy parents, though, says McIlroy sharply. I had the dream. I was the one hassling my dad to take me to the driving range every night. For the moment, he's trying his best to stay humble and keep the win at the Open in perspective. It's not the greatest moment of your life. It's golf, you know what I mean? People are very surprised when I say that. I realize that in the grand picture of life, golf is a game. It's there to be played and enjoyed. You play tournaments, you win some, you lose some. Big deal. The next item, Shelby's need for speed. Carroll Shelby is a lucky man, said John Wilde in Men's Journal. The 88-year-old former auto racer and designer, most famously of the Shelby Cobra, which he designed for Ford in the 1960s, came to his love of automobiles in a roundabout way. I got out of the Air Force in 1945 and kept trying to go into business, trucking, chickens, ready-mixed cement, he says. Finally, a friend from high school had an old MG, and he says, let's go to a car race. I raced it, and I won. I was driving home that night and said, this may not be a way to make a living, but this is what I've always wanted. He raced professionally in the 1950s before turning to designing. The Cobra was at one time the world's fastest production car. My brand is to build ass-kickers, he says. Speed, he admits with a grin, has brought him near death a hell of a lot of times. The most frightened he's ever been, sitting upside down at 125 miles an hour, waiting for my head to hit the concrete. Oh, you can, all you can do is yell, oh, goodness. That's not exactly what he yelled, but I'll use goodness for now. And wonder how bad it's going to hurt. Happened a couple of times. It was enough to put the fear of God in him. I know there's something stronger than we are that puts this thing together, he says. And our next item, why Brinkley is done with marriage. Christy Brinkley is through with love, said Helena de Bertadano in the London Telegraph. The former supermodel, who is 57 years old, has been married 4 times. I have to be careful in husband, she admits. Unfortunately, I trust everybody. I just think everybody is great. After divorcing her first husband, French artist Jean-Francois Allot, she married singer Bill Joel in 1985. At first, the marriage was a blast, she says. We literally never stopped singing the whole time we were together. But the music stopped nearly a decade later, and they divorced in 1994. By then, Brinkley had fallen for Ricky Taubman, a real estate developer who'd been in a helicopter crash with her. I even named my perfume after husband number 3. Believe, because I still believed in love. They lasted only a year, but it was husband number 4, Peter Cook, who really soured her. Cook had an affair with his 19-year-old assistant, leading to an ugly divorce. I can now say unequivocally, I would never get married again. Should she ever design a perfume based on her feelings about marriage, she says she has the perfect name, Stinks. I would have to call it Stinks. Now, from the People's section of the Week magazine, let's turn to the weekly section entitled The Briefing. This week, the specific article is called The Outsider. Ron Paul may not win the GOP's 2012 presidential nomination, but his views have helped reshape the party. How influential is Ron Paul? For more than 3 decades, Paul's brand of uncompromising libertarianism left him on the fringes of the Republican Party. Only 3 of the 416 bills he has sponsored in Congress since 1997 even made it out of committee, and 2 of those were defeated. But events of the last 3 years, including the meltdown of the financial sector, massive government bailouts of private industry, and an exploding federal deficit, have turned his warnings on the dangers of debt and excessive spending into mainstream Republican thought. The Tea Party has embraced Paul's belief that the best government is the least government, and that taxes are an intrusion on individual liberty. Time has come around to where the people are agreeing with much of what I've been saying for 30 years, Paul said in May, when he announced his 3rd campaign for the GOP presidential nomination. The time is right. Has the GOP embraced all his ideas? No, many of them are still anathema to the Republican establishment. A self-described strict constitutionalist, Paul believes the federal government should do almost nothing beyond punishing fraud and warding off foreign attacks. He has denounced U.S. militarism and argued that the U.S. should not meddle in the Middle East or the affairs of other nations. He's voted against everything from humanitarian relief for Hurricane Katrina victims to granting a congressional gold medal to Rosa Parks. It wasn't personal. He also opposed awards for Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II. Given the chance, he'd shutter the Federal Reserve, the Internal Revenue Service, and unconstitutional domestic bureaucracies like the Departments of Education, Energy, and Commerce. And although he's a devout Christian, the 12-term congressman from Texas would legalize prostitution, heroin, and cocaine. If people are only free to make good decisions, Paul said, they are not truly free. He is not one to make concessions. I don't like the word compromise, he said. You give up half your beliefs. How did Paul come to his views? He traces his sense of personal responsibility and self-reliance to his hard-working family in Pittsburgh. At age 5, Paul started working at his father's small dairy, earning a penny every time he spotted a dirty bottle on the conveyor belt. He later delivered newspapers and mowed lawns and helped pay his own college tuition. While studying medicine at Duke University, he discovered the work of Austrian economists Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, who championed unregulated markets and sound currency. When President Nixon abandoned the gold standard in 1971, Paul said, "I decided to speak out." He predicted that a Federal Reserve delinked from gold would print too much money, resulting in a housing bubble, a devalued dollar, massive foreign borrowing, and recession. He still sees a return to the gold standard as the only way to put the U.S. back on a secure financial footing. What kinds of people support Paul? His unusual ideas have attracted an equally unusual band of supporters, ranging from pot-smoking college students to hardcore fiscal conservatives. What they have in common is fervent enthusiasm for his message of individual liberty. When people come to believe in Ron Paul, there is a passion that burns within us, said Elizabeth Day, 57, a 2012 Paul campaign volunteer. His fans back their love with money. Paul's presidential campaign received $4.5 million in donations in the second quarter of 2011, more than all of his competitors except Mitt Romney. The Paulites also turn out en masse whenever there's a GOP presidential straw poll. Can Paul win the 2012 presidential nomination? History suggests not. In 1988, when Paul ran as the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate, he won just 0.5% of the vote. In the 2008 GOP primaries, he took 5.6%. Today, Paul is polling between 7 and 8%, far behind Republican frontrunners Romney and Michelle Bachmann. Ironically, the resonance of Paul's anti-Washington message could be undermining his 2012 campaign. The GOP field is crowded with candidates who have adopted his argument for stripped-down government. Paul's rivals, moreover, aren't tied to libertarian policies that spook most Republicans, such as legalizing heroin and bringing all U.S. troops home. The conservatives who might have gone with him in the past have enough other choices at this time, said Fran Wendelboe, a former Republican New Hampshire state representative. So why is Paul running? The message has always been more important than the office for Paul, who will retire from Congress next year. He sees every TV interview or Republican debate as a chance to persuade more Americans of the merits of libertarianism and to wake them up to the tyranny of central government. As awareness of his stance grows, he believes so does the chance that a like-minded candidate, perhaps his son, Rand Paul, a Tea Party idol and Kentucky senator, might one day win the White House. Politicians don't amount to much, said Paul, but ideas do. In a related article for this briefing, it's entitled "The Civil Rights Versus the Free Market." The 1964 Civil Rights Act helped end racial segregation in the U.S., but if Paul had been in Congress at the time, he would have voted against this landmark piece of legislation. His problem with the law, he recently explained, was its property rights element, not the fact that it brought about greater racial equality. In Paul's strict libertarian ideology, the federal government has no right to tell a private business what it can or cannot do on its own property. So any hairdresser who wants to bar black people from his or her salon should be able to do so. Paul says that this argument doesn't make him a racist, and he contends that racist businesses would be punished by customers and by the free market itself. Any business owner that did ban blacks, he said, would be an idiot and would be out of business pretty quickly. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the best columns in the U.S. for this past week. The first one is entitled "America's Underpaid Workforce." It's written by Harold Meyerson in the Washington Post. If you're wondering why American consumers are still flat on their backs, said Harold Meyerson, it's not only that about 10% of them are unemployed, it's also that the other 90% are underpaid. My source here isn't a lefty think tank, but J.P. Morgan Chase, which recently told private banking clients that U.S. salaries are now at a 50-year low relative to company sales and GDP. At the same time, the average profit margins of major companies have risen to nearly 13%, the highest level since the 1960s. The steady shrinkage of wages and benefits, Chase has calculated, is responsible for 75% of the boom in corporate profit margins. To state this more simply, profits are up because wages are down. Why are American workers going in reverse? Simple. They no longer have any leverage. Unions have withered, and the unemployed will only be too glad to take your job, as will 2 billion Asians who will work for half your pay. So the money produced by everyone's hard work gets funneled to the guys at the top, or stays on the balance sheet. For anyone who draws a paycheck, this is a catastrophe. Where's the outrage? The next column is entitled, A President Who Has Migraines? By Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. Presidential aspirant Michelle Bachmann, we now know, suffers from migraines, said Jeff Jacoby. So what? From this portentous tone of last week's leak by former aides, you would think that Bachmann's occasional headaches make her unfit to be president. These unnamed sources claim that Representative Bachmann gets incapacitating migraines as often as once a week, requiring heavy pill use to manage. All very melodramatic, but migraines haven't hampered Bachmann's meteoric political rise, nor would they prevent her carrying out the duties of the Oval Office. More than 35 million Americans suffer from migraines. As I can tell you from personal experience, they hurt like hell, but you can function with them. Congress's attending physician said that Bachmann's infrequent migraines are easily controlled by common non-narcotic drugs. Besides, Bachmann is in good company. Thomas Jefferson had migraines so severe he called them paroxysms of excruciating pain. Ulysses Grant had them, too. Bachmann may or may not be elected the next U.S. president, but if she is, she wouldn't be the first one to live with migraine headaches. And our next column is entitled, Letting the Pirates Run Free, by Stephen Carter in the DailyBeast.com. 2 years ago, President Obama and European leaders promised to halt the rise of piracy in the Indian Ocean and the Arabian Sea, said Stephen Carter. They've failed. In the first 6 months of 2011, attacks on ships by Somali pirates hit a record high. Ransoms are up from $150,000 per hijacked ship in 2005 to over $5 million today. Piracy's annual toll on the shipping industry is expected to climb another $5 billion to a total of $15 billion over the next 3 years. Despite this growing menace, NATO has consistently turned down requests to deploy more battleships to the region. Why? The Western navies are too busy in Libya. This overstretch should serve as a warning to President Obama, who is planning to slice up to $900 billion from the Pentagon's budget. The U.S. Navy is already reeling under budgetary constraints. 20% of its vessels aren't combat ready, and half of the Navy's air fleet is in disrepair. Any further cuts will make it impossible for the world's lone superpower to safeguard international sea lanes and protect global trade. We now face a stark choice: spend what's needed to defend the seas or abandon them to gangsters and pirates. And those were the best columns from the United States this week, according to The Week magazine. Now we're going to turn to that final section in the towards the end of the magazine called The Last Word, always an interesting and provocative section. This week, the title of the column is Not Our Parents' Divorce. We were best friends and loving parents, says Susan Gregory Thomas, and we believed it couldn't happen to us. Every generation has its life-defining moments. If you want to find out what it was for a member of the greatest generation, you ask, where were you on D-Day? For baby boomers, the questions are, where were you when Kennedy was shot? Or, what were you doing when Nixon resigned? For most of my generation, Generation X, born between 1965 and 1980, there is only one question. When did your parents get divorced? Our lives have been framed by the answer. Ask us. We remember everything. When my dad left in the spring of 1981 and moved five states away with his executive assistant and her four kids, the world as I had known it came to an end. My mother, formerly a legal erudite figure, was transformed into a phantom in a sweaty nightgown and matted hair, howling on the floor of our gray-carpeted playroom. My brother, a sweet, goofy boy, grew into a sad, glowering giant, barricaded in his room with dark graphic novels and computer games. I spent the rest of middle and high school getting into trouble in suburban Philadelphia, chain-smoking, doing drugs, getting kicked out of schools, spending a good part of my senior year in a psychiatric ward. Whenever I saw my father, which was rarely, per his preference, he grew more and more to embody Darth Vader, a brutal machine encasing raw human guts. Growing up, my brother and I were often left to our own devices, members of the giant flock of 1970s and 80s-era migrant latchkey kids. Our suburb was littered with sad-eyed, bruised nomads who wandered back and forth from used record shops to the sheds behind the train station, where they got high and then trudged off, back and forth from their mothers' houses during the week to their fathers' apartments every other weekend. The divorced parents of a boy I knew in high school installed him in his own apartment because neither wanted him at home. Naturally, we all descended on his place after school, sometimes during school, to drink and do drugs. He was always wasted, no matter what time we arrived. A few years ago, a friend told me that she had learned that he had drunk himself to death by age 30. Whatever happens, we're never going to get divorced. Over the course of 16 years, I said that often to my husband, especially after our children were born. Apparently, much of my generation feels at least roughly the same way. Divorce rates, which peaked in 1980, are now at their lowest level since 1970. In fact, the often cited statistic that half of all marriages end in divorce was true only in the 1970s, in other words, our parents' marriages. My generation is marrying later, often living together. We need to know, are we best friends, good roommates? I believe that I had married my best friend as fervently as I believe that I'd never get divorced. No marital scenario, I told myself, could become so bleak as to compel me to embed my children in the torture of a split family. I wasn't the only one. According to a 2004 study, Generation X went through its all-important formative years as one of the least parented, least nurtured generations in U.S. history. Census data show that almost half of us come from split families. 40% were latchkey kids. People my parents' age say things like, "Of course you'll feel devastated by divorce, honey, but sometimes everyone is happier." Such sentiments bring to mind a set of statistics in Generations by William Strauss and Neil Howe that has stuck with me. In 1962, half of all adult women believed that parents in bad marriages should stay together for the children's sake. By 1980, only one in five felt this way. Four-fifths of those divorced adults profess to being happier afterward. The author's right, but a majority of their children feel otherwise. But a majority of their children feel otherwise. There is something intolerable about that clause. I can't help feeling that every divorce, in its way, is a reenactment of Medea, the wailing, murderously bereft mother, the cold father protecting his pristine new family, the children dead. It wasn't until my daughter was a few months old that it dawned on me that when the pediatricians and child care books referred to separation anxiety, they were referring to the baby's psyche, not mine. It occurred to me that perhaps my own origins had something to do with what a freak show I was. After hearing about my background, a distinguished therapist said to me, "You are a war orphan." Makes sense. Having grown up without stable homes, we pour everything that we have into giving our children just that. Indeed, Gen Xers' quest for perfect nests drove us to take out more home equity loans and spend more money on house remodeling per capita than any generation before, according to Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Marketing surveys reveal that we don't seek parenting advice from our moms. Instead, says the research, we depend on the people who actually raised us, albeit Wolfpack style, our friends. To allow our own marriages to end in divorce is to live our worst childhood fears. More horrifying, it is to inflict the unthinkable on what we most love and want to protect, our children. It is like slashing open our own wounds and turning the knife on our babies. To consider it is unbearable. My husband and I were as obvious as points on a graph in a Generation X marriage study. We were together for nearly 8 years before we got married, and even though statistics show that divorce rates are 48% higher for cohabitants, we paid no heed. We also paid no heed to his Catholic parents, who composed one of the rare, reassuringly unified couples I've ever met, when they warned us that we should wait until we were married to live together. As they put it, being pals and roommates is different from being husband and wife. How bizarrely old-fashioned and sexist. We didn't need anything so naive or retro as marriage. Please, we were best friends. Sociologists, anthropologists, and other manner of cultural observers tell us that members of Generation X are more emotionally invested in our spouses than previous generations were to theirs. We are best friends. Our marriages are genuine partnerships. Hell yes, we're helicopter parents. Those of us who survived the wreckage of split families were determined never to inflict such wounds on our own children. We knew better. We were doing everything differently, and the fundamental premise was simple. The principle that kids come first meant no divorce. But marriages do dissolve, even among those determined never to let it happen. By the end of my marriage, my husband and I had become wretched, passive-aggressive roommates. I had not washed a dish in a year. My husband had not been able to find time to read the book I had written. We rarely spoke, except about logistics. We hadn't slept in the same room for at least 2 years, a side effect of the nighttime musical bed routine that parents of so many young children play in semi-consciousness. Yet I never considered divorce. It never even entered my mind. I was grateful that my babies had a perfect father for our family meals, for the stability of our home, for neighborhood playdates. But then one evening I found myself where I vowed I'd never be, miserable in tears, telling my husband that we were like siblings who couldn't stand each other rather than a couple, and listening as my husband said he felt as though we had never really been a couple and regretted that we hadn't split up a decade earlier. "I'm done," he said. The awful finality of it roared in like an enormous black cloud, blotting out the sky. It was done. That was 4 years ago, and I wonder every day if there was something we could have done differently. I thought I'd made exactly the right choices by doing everything differently from my parents, everything. I had married the kindest, most stable person I'd ever known. I nursed, loved, read to, and lolled about with my babies, restructured and reimagined my career so that they would be secure, happy, attended to. My husband and I made the happiest, most comfy nest possible. We worked as a team. We loved our kids. We did everything right, better than right. And yet divorce came. In spite of everything, I don't know what makes a good marriage. I'm inclined to think Mark Twain was right when he wrote in an 1894 journal, "No man or woman really knows what perfect love is until they have been married a quarter of a century." But I did know something about divorce, and I wanted, and my former husband wanted, to do it as well as possible. Many of us do. The phrase friendly divorce may strike some as an oxymoron, but it is increasingly a trend and a real possibility. Relatively inexpensive and non-adversarial divorce mediation rather than pricey, contentious litigation is now more common than ever. Many of us are all too familiar with the brutal court fights of our parents, and we're not doing it to our kids, too. According to a recent study, couples who decide to mediate their divorce are more likely than those who go to court to talk regularly about the children's needs and problems, to participate in school and special events, daily activities, holidays, and vacations. We may not make it in marriage, but we still want to make it as parents. In the 70s, only 9 states permitted joint custody. Today, every state has adopted it. It was once typical for dads to recede from family life or drop out altogether in the wake of divorce. But dads are critical in helping kids to develop self-esteem and constructive habits of behavior. A 2009 study published in the journal Child Development found, for example, that teenagers with involved fathers are less likely to engage in risky sexual activities. Joint custody also reduces familial strife. Couples with such arrangements report less conflict with their former spouses than sole custody parents do, an important finding, since judges have worried, historically, that joint custody exposes children to ongoing parental fighting. Some divorced couples have even decided to continue living together in different parts of the home, or to swap out each week in order to maintain some measure of stability for their kids. I have yet to meet the divorced mother or father who feels like a good parent, who professes to feeling happier with how their children are now being raised. Many of us ended up inflicting pain on our children, which we've done everything to avoid. But we have not had our parents' divorces either. We can only hope that in this, we have done it differently in the right way. And this article is from In Spite of Everything by Susan Gregory Thomas, and it was read and printed by permission of Random House. And now we'll turn to the section from the Week magazine called Talking Points. The first article I'm going to read to you now is called Polygamy and Why Is It Legal? If consenting adults create a marriage of more than two people, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune, do we have any right to stop them? Current law says we do. 9 states specifically ban polygamy, and 49 have bigamy laws that can be used to prosecute plural families. Now Cody Brown, a member of a renegade Mormon sect, has filed a lawsuit challenging anti-bigamy laws in his home state of Utah. Brown came to the attention of state authorities last year after he and his 4 spiritual wives starred in a reality TV series called Sister Wives. Facing a criminal investigation, all 5 were forced to flee Utah with their 16 children in tow. Now they want to come back, and Brown is making a perfectly reasonable argument. He isn't demanding that Utah change its law or recognize his spiritual marriages, since he's legally married to only one of his wives. He's just asking to be let the hell alone. Utah can't afford to leave polygamists alone, said Scott Senjo in the Salt Lake City Tribune. People who reject society's norms, past experience shows, often deem laws irrelevant as well, and are prone to engage in welfare fraud and tax evasion. Steeped in a patriarchal worldview, polygamists are more likely to indulge in statutory rape, child abuse, and incest. If Brown isn't stopped, said Brian Rahm in Human Events, the implications for marriage could be grave. As we social conservatives once warned, the legalization of same-sex marriage in some states has now opened the door to demands that government recognize other socially destructive conduct, including polygamy. We've heard these arguments before, said Brown's attorney, Jonathan Turley, in the New York Times, but my client is asking only for privacy, nothing more. In our society, it's not uncommon for men or women to have multiple sexual partners or to have children with these partners. Yet because Brown has stated a commitment to all his spiritual wives rather than simply running around on his first wife, it is considered a crime. Civil libertarians are afraid to embrace his cause, fearing it undermines the case for same-sex unions. But consenting polygamists deserve the same right to privacy as gay people. The Browns aren't accused of hurting their kids or coercing minors. They just want the right to create a loving family according to the values of their faith. Why not live and let live? And the next item, Murdoch, mortally wounded. The end is near for Rupert Murdoch, said David Carr in the New York Times. With his media kingdom crumbling around him, Murdoch has sacrificed his most trusted lieutenants in desperate attempt to survive the phone hacking and corruption scandal sparked by his British tabloids. Next, to preserve his role as News Corp CEO and the company itself, Murdoch may have to sacrifice his own flesh and blood. James Murdoch, 38, has spent his life being groomed to step into his father's shoes, but two former company executives have challenged his testimony before the British Parliament last week. If he lied about not knowing that phone hacking was common practice, James Murdoch is done. His 80-year-old father may be next. It was the senior Murdoch, after all, who created the win-by-any-means culture that turned News Corp into an international media behemoth, living by its own rules and operating beyond consequence. And now, as we reach the end of our program today, a couple of short items here. The heat wave that gripped much of the country in recent weeks affected more than 200 million Americans and set hundreds of new records. Among them were 66 new all-time high temperatures, including 108 degrees in Newark, New Jersey, and 103 degrees in Boston. In large portions of Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas, the thermometers topped 100 degrees for more than 20 consecutive days. Despite cutting $12 billion in costs over the past 4 years and eliminating more than 200,000 career positions in the past decade, the Postal Service is expected to lose $8 billion for the second consecutive year. Mail volume dropped by about 20% from 2006 to 2010. Almost 30% of Americans ages 12 and over reported binge drinking five or more drinks in one sitting in the past month, according to a federal report. And Warner Brothers still collects about $2 million a year from public performances of Happy Birthday, having brought the rights to Patti and Mildred Hill's song back in 1988. And let's take a look at our poll watch for this week. Republicans have made major gains among white voters. In 2008, the GOP held a 2-point edge among whites, but now 52% of whites identify as Republicans, compared with 39% who identify as Democrats. And when asked if they approved of God's performance, 52% of Americans say they approve, while 9% disapprove. 40% really just aren't sure. Well, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Please be sure to join us next time. I hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after this broadcast. So long, until next time.